Victory or death!
Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death! Victory or death!
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Radio Free Virginia, coming to you from a secret, undisclosed bunker location in the heart of the Commonwealth of Virginia. I'm Hank Reardon, your host, bringing you what you need to stay in the fight to preserve your liberty. Today's episode is 21-21, the 21st episode of 2021. Well, that's a lot of 21s. The best way to listen is with the Podbean app or the Stitcher app or one of the many apps. But I use Podbean, works really well, and would encourage you to get that. And also, please like, subscribe, and follow this podcast, whatever the methodology is for that. Share it with your friends. Tell people you like it and that they should listen to this. Maybe you're having a conversation about something. You think, hey, that's just like what Hank was saying on the show. I should tell my friend about that. That would help get the word out about the show. You can find more. You can find more about the podcast at radiofreevirginia.com and tell your friends. I'd like to thank the show sponsor, Acticare of the Blue Ridge, ACTIKARE.com/blue-ridge. You're looking for in-home senior care for your senior loved one when you can't be there. Get in touch with them, and they will take good care of you if you are in Smith Mountain Lake, Bedford, Roanoke, Campbell, Lynchburg, out in the country. Get in touch with them today. And they're good people. Take care of your good people so that they can be safe and well cared for. ACTIKARE.com/blue-ridge. I'm going to talk about a few different things, share some articles, and share some different things with you today. And I've got an interview that I did over the phone with John Galt, who's been on the show before. Get some interesting insights about some different topics. I'm going to preload some of the things that we talked about based on articles that I've read, and that will help kind of set the tone. And I'll probably have to break that up into a couple shows because I've got over 60 minutes of good stuff with him, and that's a little bit long for you. Without, if I add in the other stuff, it's going to be a little bit long. So that's the way that's going to work. Want to remind you that I've got the t-shirt store, the merch store set up. And if you'd like to go and help me test it. And if you like the idea of having a shirt that says you were not made to fit in, you were born to stand out, then I would encourage you to go check that out. Click the link at radiofreevirginia.com. It says shop and get yourself a shirt. I'm working on getting others, working on getting women's designs as well, and mugs and other cool stuff, merch. Yeah. Support the show, helps keep things going, and you can have some cool stuff too. All right, so this first one is an email from Rand Paul that I received. You know, usually these are fundraising emails and whatnot. So he sends me this email. It says, "This week, a left-wing militant sent a package to my house with a picture of a gun to my head and an unidentified white powder inside. I know the perils of being in the public spotlight, but this incident truly made me fear for my safety and the safety of my family. I've been targeted a shocking number of times by left-wing militants. In 2017, I was at the congressional baseball practice where a socialist gunman tried to wipe out dozens of Republican congressmen. Later that year, a neighbor of mine launched a vicious assault that left me with half of my lung needing to be removed, and nearly ended up being far worse than that." I didn't know about that one. "Last year, a bloodthirsty BLM mob surrounded me on the streets of Washington, D.C., and I was fortunate to escape just in time. And how have left-wing activists responded to these savage attacks? They have cheered. They have vowed that more attacks are on the way. Only days before this latest attack on my family, a former pop musician named Richard Marx praised my neighbor on Twitter for his bloody assault, which nearly incapacitated me. Needless to say, I've had some difficult conversations with my family about these events that have transpired. They understand the dangers that we're all in. They know what the left wants to happen to us. But we have one message to share with these leftist militants who are attempting to do us harm. We will not be intimidated. I was elected to the United States Senate for one critical reason: to preserve the blessings of liberty that our founding fathers bestowed on us. This is an opportunity for all of us to rise up and send a message in unison. We will not let the socialists scare us into submission. I talk a lot about violence on this show, and specifically what the left is doing, but I kind of want to set the stage for the interview I did with John Galt a little bit. The left has this viewpoint that, one, they're godless, so there's no God, that they are God, and that truth is whatever they say it is. Now, truth comes in three forms. There's our truth, there's their truth, and there's the truth. There is no, it's not fungible. It does not, you cannot stretch it and make it whatever you want it to be. Truth is truth. It will always be truth. It is what it is. But they live in a world where either one of two things, they're a relativist, a modernist, or they're a postmodernist. So relativism says there's no absolute truth, which is silly because you slap a man across the face, it's absolutely going to hurt. That's an absolute truth. There's lots of absolute truths. It's silly. Well, postmodernism says, well, there's absolute truth. You just can't know what it is. You've heard of people say water's not wet and things like that. So I would ask you this. Can we operate on their set of standards? Their set of standards says truth is what you make it. And so if my truth says it's okay to throw communists out of helicopters, is it okay to throw communists out of helicopters? I'm using their standard. That's their standard. Their standard is all violence is okay. Their standard is it's okay to send a package with white powder and a threat to a United States senator. Their standard is it's okay to shoot up a bunch of Republicans. Their standard is it's okay to stab and attack and do who knows what to people. Oh, well, now we can't stoop to their level, you would say. Who made that rule? They're evil. And they must be stopped. So think about that. That's going to come back to that in the interview that I did. We're going to talk a little bit about some of this stuff. Next article I found is from a website called Kunstler. And the topic is one that has a bad word in it, so I can't say. But I'll say that this is titled The National Horror Story Hour. Questions du jour. Can the U.S. government make itself more untrustworthy? Has it become an enemy of the people? Just wondering. What would be worse, actually, is if we learn that the American culture is untrustworthy. Since politics is downstream of culture, it would be equivalent writ large of human personality at war with itself, unable to trust its own thoughts and actions, which perhaps explains the seeming psychosis raging through our society at the moment. The hallucinatory delusions of the day are exactly what you'd expect in the kind of personality undergoing a psychotic stress fracture, like the character Norman Bates in Hitchcock's classic horror movie, Psycho. Poor Norman, or Mr. Bates, as Hitch playfully had the other characters call him, developed the unfortunate habit of dressing up like his deceased mother and slashing to death any other female for whom Mr. Bates had impure thoughts. That was the 60s version of the transsexual story hour. We've come a long way, baby, since those innocent days. In today's day, another part of the collective personality is suddenly coming apart. Science, or the science, as the lingo has it these days. The science is a system of hypotheses and proofs that normally play the hero's role in the task of determining reality, especially about those things that are dangerous to mankind. The science is supposedly behind what we know about the COVID-19 pandemic that has turned America and much of the world upside down. The science has become so untrustworthy that an awful lot of people harbor suspicions that it has been running a number on them for the past year. Huh, that's true. In the early going of the war on COVID-19, the science told its soldiers, the doctors, to jam ventilators down patients' throats. Oops, that didn't work so well. The science told everyone to forget about ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, zinc, and vitamin D. The science told New York Governor Andrew Cuomo to stash COVID-19 infected patients in nursing homes. The science told everybody don't bother with masks, then to definitely wear masks, then to maybe not wear masks, then to wear double masks, then to get vaccinated and wear masks. Golly, what to believe. Some people began to think that the science was full of it, which is, let's face it, a dangerous thought and something which, thank goodness, Facebook, Twitter, and Google corrected for us. One thing the science remained adamant about the whole year was that COVID-19 did not come from the Wuhan, China Institute of Virology, where, and to which it just happened, one of the U.S. government's knights of the science, Dr. Anthony Fauci, was funneling U.S. tax-funded grant money for the purpose of doing gain-of-function research on exotic bat coronaviruses. Gosh, why would you even do that? Doesn't gain-of-function equal make it more deadly? Supposedly, to gain knowledge so that mankind will be prepared to fight the emergence of deadly bat viruses that somehow manage to sneak into the human population at some future date. These things can happen, you know. We've already tangled with bird flu and swine flu, so deadly bat flu could hardly be out of the question. Of course, one of the dangers when you are playing with deadly respiratory viruses in a lab is that lab workers might inhale the virus or two and become infected with a specimen that the science has engineered to be especially troublesome. But that was very unlikely, maintained Dr. Anthony Fauci, chief science advisor to the president. Until this month, when Dr. Fauci conceded to the Senate committee that perhaps an investigation was warranted to find out if, perchance, COVID-19 escaped from the Wuhan lab, since it turns out the Wuhan lab was such a sloppy operation that its level of safety was comparable to an ordinary dentist's office. It also turns out, according to the Wall Street Journal report this week, that three Wuhan lab workers did indeed need to be hospitalized in November of 2019, which was around the time the bug got loose among the civilians of Wuhan City, while Chinese tourists and workers were still winging around the world in airplanes by the tens of thousands, prompting one to wonder whether, also perchance, this was something that the CCP wanted to happen. Now that, in quotes, safe and effective vaccines are available against COVID-19, the science is urging everybody to take it pronto, and the government is assisting in the distribution and deployment of vaccinations, even to the very borderline of coercing citizens into it by turning the vaccine hesitant into social pariahs. No restaurant meals or ball games for you, science-offending trolls. How's that working? According to Dr. Fauci and several other knights of the science, I just love that, more than half the people on their staffs got vaxxed voluntarily. More than half. Now that's a ringing vote of confidence in the science. What he's saying there is half, not all, but half of the people got the vaccine in, you know, the Knights of the Science. Never mind that the vaxxers being deployed got exempted from the normal years-long safety trials that the science previously deemed essential for new vaccines and received special liability protection against lawsuits should something go awry with the jabs. And never mind the strange side effects being reported, ranging from human reproductive problems to fatal blood clots. And never mind that apparently quite a few people who got the vax have also gotten COVID-19. And never mind that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has continued to flutter about her place of business wearing color-coordinated face masks. That's what I hear when I hear her speak. What she sounds like, despite being vaxxed and spending her time among colleagues who are all vaxxed up. Oh, I wonder if she was actually vaxxed. I wish she wasn't. I'll tell you what, I wish this virus did what it says, they say, the science says it does. Because it would clean house of these geriatric, senile dementia patients that we have running our country right now. That would be good. Standing by and all that to see how the vaccine beta testers make out over the somewhat longer haul. Meanwhile, the next national reality test is underway in Arizona, just now gearing up in the state of Georgia, too. That would be election science, or the hypothesis and proofs of how ballots are cast and votes are tallied. These are also matters that our knights of public management, such as Arizona Governor Doug Ducey and Georgia Governor Brian Kemp and their secretaries of state, Hobbs and Raffensperger, declare to be unworthy of investigation. And yet, investigations are apparently proceeding against their wishes and convictions, thanks to the Arizona State Senate and some Georgia judges. Standing by now to see how much more psychotic America's collective persona grows as that nasty business creeps forward. I know it was a little long, but I had to read the whole thing because it was just so darn good and so darn right. The science. Whether it's election science or the science. John Galt and I talk a little bit about, not necessarily COVID, but the American culture and where it's going and if it can survive and things like that. So I thought that that was good. And you can find those show notes at radiofreevirginia.com. All right, this next story I may have mentioned on a previous episode, maybe the last one or the one before that, but it's about South Africa and specifically vigilante justice. And the title, this is from a website called amren.com. I haven't spent a lot of time on the site, but author's name is Jared Taylor, American Renaissance, May 25th, 2021. On May 19th, vigilantes killed 8 suspected criminals in the Johannesburg suburb of Zandspruit, some by necklacing. The killers put car tires around their victims, filled them with gasoline, and set them on fire. This was the ANC's preferred method of execution when it was fighting apartheid. It may take as long as 20 minutes to die. This incident has been reported in South Africa, but so far we can tell, no foreign media has taken notice of it. It says vigilante killings are common in South Africa because crime is widespread and police are often ineffective. Last year, there were 903 reported cases, which I didn't know it was that many, but that's quite a lot. And there's pictures, it's pretty awful, of dead people. It says, what follows is the fullest account of the Zandspruit incident we have been able to find. And this is from another website called IOL News, and it was on May 23rd. Johannesburg, gory images of the remnants of 8 men lying with their hands tied behind their backs with rope, while their bodies are charred beyond recognition, have once more highlighted the horrors of vigilantism or mob justice in some townships and informal settlements. The 8 victims found... All right, let me stop. These were criminals. And when you have a society that isn't enforcing the law, people will enforce the law. The 8 victims found in the open field in Honeydew, informal settlement known as Zandspruit, Joburg this week, will drastically increase the 903 number of people already murdered as a result of vigilantism in the last year in South Africa. Well then, hey cops, do your job. According to the Institute for Security Studies, figures supplied by the head of justice and violence, Gareth Newman, Newham. Witnesses have alleged that some members of the community rounded up suspects by beating one after another and forcing them to point out their fellow gang members. The men were then frog marched to the open field, where one resident described the heart-wrenching scene where they were beaten up with everything at the hands of the mob, including stones, and hacked with axes or other dangerous objects while they were lying on the ground. It was horrible. They were bleeding and screaming for help while being dragged to the soccer field. The group was actually looking for 12 boys, three of whom managed to escape, said the man who seemed unaffected by what he saw. In the aftermath of the rage and mob justice, 8 men succumbed to the injuries, 4 at the scene while another 4 died at the hospital. The survivor is alleged to have been saved after pleading for his hands to be cut rather than fighting for his life after he suffered burns on both arms. I'm going to start jumping around here. So one of the residents at the scene said that although he doesn't condone what happened, these boys were very problematic. This has been going on for a while now. There are lots of these boys from different groups. These boys terrorize the community. My friend was killed by one of these groups called Triple O in 2019, he said. And here's the poll quote, and I want you to think about for America. He said one of the reasons that led to the community taking the law into their own hands was the police's lack of response to crimes. We report criminal activities to the police, but they sometimes tell us that there are no vehicles to attend to our complaints. Even those who killed my friend are out there enjoying their lives. We were told that an investigator who was dealing with the case has been transferred and that the dockets were missing. Now the community is fed up and opted to deal with these boys on their own. Coming to America, folks. This stuff's coming to Virginia because you can't defund the police. You can't hamstring them. You can't tie their hands behind their back. You can't post this stupid critical race theory crap and expect that they're just going to keep doing their jobs. What's going to happen is they'll just not do their jobs. Those that stay will be the worst, and those that don't will be the good cops, and they'll all leave. Crime is rife in this area, and when we report to the police, they don't come. You can't walk around at night and in the early hours of the morning. A week ago, a woman was robbed of her belongings on her way to the taxi rank. The police and the government have failed to deal with crime, and people are now tired. But a man named Sylvester said the incident could have been avoided if the police were responsible. Well, that's true. Again, okay, although I don't promote acts of vigilantism, I think people are fed up with crime now. They felt enough was enough and they needed to stop these boys. They found a solution to this, but a wrong one. Maybe they thought it was a good thing at the time. This wouldn't happen if the police responded to the complaints. So I don't know if the article will talk about this. We'll see if it gets to that. But they have arrested a bunch of the people responsible for this vigilante justice. So they're doing their job there. See how it works? You can't expect that you can be safe. But when you take action to be safe, they'll come down on you. Another lady said, "What happened on Wednesday is disgusting and should be condemned. No one deserves such a brutal and horrible death." My favorite. The mother of one of the victims said it was painful that her son, Lucky, 32, again, so one of the boys, right, was killed in such a gruesome manner. "I received a call that my son has been attacked by a mob. When I got there, I was told my son was dead and at the scene. I was hurt. This is very painful. Although he was addicted to drugs, my son was a very good person and wanted to take care of his family. I never thought he would die like this. At least they should have called the parents and police. I'm still asking myself why my son was killed," said the 55-year-old. I'm going to keep reading and then I'll make some comments here. "Seeing my brother at the morgue was painful. I know his friends were into drugs, but I was not aware if he was also addicted." Okay, so my comment there is, this is just like in America, the world over, parents of dirtbags just can't see what their people are doing, what their family is doing to people. St. Floyd of fentanyl, the greatest black man to ever live. He was a criminal. George Floyd was a criminal. He was committing crime when all this happened, was on drugs when all this happened, died because of drugs when all this happened. But it's all the police's fault. In this case, it's all the mob's fault. It's not his fault for being a murdering, raping drug addict, robbing people and doing crime. It's not his fault. It's not his criminal gang's fault. Ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. Same thing happened in here. Yesterday, Police Minister Bike Sele addressed the community where he admitted that the police in the area were not doing their jobs properly. He admitted to those gathered at the scene of the crime, the soccer field, to listen to him, that there were about 500 reported cases of robbery, theft, rape, and drug dealing in the area that police have failed to solve. I know apartheid was a horrible thing, but this wasn't happening then. South Africa was not in the state it was in. It is in today, before the communists took over. Think about that when you think about what's coming. He also promised the residents that he would be dealing with police corruption at first. It may remove some police in the process while urging them to come forward in a week or so to reopen the charges. I love the apologist attitude. It is so funny how humanity is the same the world over. According to Newman, the scourge of vigilantism occurs where there are ambitious local leaders who need to assert their authority in the community. He said these leaders believe this can be achieved through dealing with those seen as responsible for local crime problems through vigilante action. Often in these communities, there are low levels of trust in the police and a sense that police do not effectively serve their safety needs, because they don't. This can be because the local police are under-resourced and cannot adequately respond to the local crime challenges. Or there may be corrupt police officials who take bribes from criminal elements, particularly those involved in illicit activities such illegal gambling, sale of alcohol, and drugs. Or the police may be seen as disinterested in servicing the community when they report crimes. In 2020, Honeydew Residence, which is a suburb of Zandspruit, reported 10,214 serious crime cases. Think about that. What do we have here in our area? It's not anywhere close to that, including 354 cases of common robbery, 341 of robbery at residential premises, and 183 sexual offenses. And that's just the reported ones. So you double that number. I guarantee you can double that number. That's almost 400 rapes. Oh my gosh. We would be dragging people out of their homes and killing them ourselves if that was going on. If my wife was attacked and I knew where the guy was and the cops weren't dealing with it, you don't think for a second that I wouldn't go deal with that guy? Give me a break. I just love this. There's low levels of trust in the police and they don't effectively serve their safety needs because they don't. All right, so next up is going to be an interview with John Galt. And this is actually part two. I'm going to do part one next week. And so part two, we're talking about a couple different things. Cancel culture, we're talking about the South Africa that I mentioned, and a few other topics. And if you haven't had a chance to go listen to the other interviews I've done with John Galt, actually in studio, I would encourage you to do that because he's a real good fourth dimensional thinker. And I like his opinion on the topics of the day and what's going on. And he's a good student of history. So I think you'll really enjoy this interview. I was reading this really interesting article about South Africa and what they've experienced. And then, and I started thinking about that and I started thinking about, and then I watched these videos, active self-protection and other things where he's showcasing, you know, criminal incidents, and there's all kinds of stuff, South Africa, Brazil, Venezuela, you know, all the, you know, wonderful socialist utopias. And I started thinking that is a perfect picture of where we're headed if we don't knock it off, is these essentially, criminalocracy where, you know, you've got the politicians giving their friends the money and the friends are doling it back to the politicians and, you know, this circular thing. And then ultimately it's this, we're all sitting here wondering, oh, you know, we got to just vote more Republican or we're going to fight it in the courts. And I've said on the show that, you know, ballot box, soapbox and jury box, but those aren't working. The only one left is the cartridge box. You know, at what point do we look and go, you know what? I'm fed up with this, or not we, because I think we're already seeing it and already think we're there, but I don't know where does the rest of society, you know, look at that?
So I think the trend lines are bad, and looking at places, you know, like South Africa, Brazil, or other examples of this, I think there are some parallels there of where we're headed as a country. And in terms of, you know, what's the breaking point in the American people? I think that we have to remember that people's breaking point varies very much by your direct contact with whatever the problem is. You know, there's that old saying, when your friend loses his job, it's a recession. When you lose your job, it's a depression. So this is a similar thing you see with, for example, what happened in 2020 with all the rioting. You know, if you're sitting in Idaho or Utah or Southern Virginia or Texas somewhere, and you're watching the news, you're like, man, looks terrible in Portland. Man, looks terrible in Seattle. And it kind of, you wonder if it's going to come to your town. You wonder if it's going to become a national problem. But it doesn't really spur a lot of people to action because it's somebody else's problem. Now, when it's your city, I think there's a lot of Americans who already hit that breaking point. It's where you saw, you know, Kyle Rittenhouse and a handful of his buddies going like, no, we're not going to let communists burn down our town. We're going to go and fight it. I mean, so this happened at various places, you know, around the country where small groups of people with weapons defended their homes and defended their property. So I don't think there's exactly a national breaking point exactly. I think the more appropriate question to ask is, at what point does a situation become so degraded that you have a critical mass of people who are experiencing this problem in their face, in their backyard, and then they take up arms to stop it? And I still don't think that necessarily exactly has to transform into a civil war. It has a possibility to. But I think initially when we see this start to unravel, it's going to be kind of what we saw on a smaller scale in 2020, where it's small groups of people saying no, this far, no further. You know, they burned down that store, but not burned down mine. They raided that house, but they're not raiding mine. So I think that that tipping point's already been reached in the minds of a lot of people. It's just very localized based on circumstances. The other thing, too, about, you know, has the jury box and the ballot box actually been exhausted? I would argue in a lot of situations, no. So something that's going on right now is with Ron DeSantis in Florida. You know, he's showing the country that if you are a governor, you have broad power to push back against the federal government, and you can actually carve out, you know, for lack of a better phrase, a true sanctuary territory where people can be free. At the state level, so that can be done. And there's a lot of deep red states, you know, Idaho, Wyoming, Utah, again, out in the west. You have Texas. You know, why didn't Texas do what Florida did? Why in a state like Wyoming that has 70%+ Republican turnout every presidential election? You know, the Democrats basically don't exist. Same thing with Idaho and Utah. Why aren't those states as free or more free than Florida? So I think, again, it goes back to the conservative movement has to ask itself, what do we really want? And what are we asking our politicians to do? Because I still think there's a lot of territory in the United States that if you elected people who are willing to use their power to push back against the left, you could carve out entire sectors of the United States that could be free from most tyranny. And Ron DeSantis has shown that it's possible. You can even push back against big tech. You don't have to have a national platform even to carve out territories of freedom.
Well, so using the jury box and using the, you know, what bureaucracies we can use to uncover and things, I think ultimately you got all these people saying, you know, we need to get in the fight and we need to, you know, get these, like Virginia, we've got, you know, Youngkin, I'm not thrilled about. But I don't care at this point. He's not a Democrat. And then Winsome Sears, she looks pretty awesome. And then Jason Miaris is pretty great for Attorney General. So we've got three good candidates. And people are, oh, we need to get in the fight. We need to get these people elected. Well, I think the problem that we're going to see is you have to find a way to restore that belief that there's integrity in our voting system. And I think that for the vast majority of us, we don't see that. That we've taken these things to courts and the judges laugh. We've, you know, we're fighting these at the local registrar's office and getting stonewalled. So until we can push past that and solve this problem, I don't see us ever winning again because nobody believes that you can, so they're not going to show up.
So I agree and I disagree. I would say that what you're seeing in Virginia, and this should be a warning to every state that is considered a purple state or there's a possibility of Democrats gaining control of their state, or for that matter, if they've been led by really weak Republicans. I think you do make a valid point that once your voting system has been corrupted, once the integrity of the vote has been compromised, it's almost impossible to get it back. And that is a significant difference. And that's again why I say I think this is localized, right? So Virginia is this example where once the Democrats got control of the Virginia legislature and the governor's mansion, they pushed through a bunch of things that made cheating during election a lot easier. And during the, you know, 2020 election, there's a lot of rampant voter fraud, accusations of fraud, and the accusations are pretty credible, not just in Virginia, but a lot of different places. And that is a good point. Once you've actually let them have control long enough to destroy your legal structure in your state, then you are in the position of the founding fathers to a certain extent. Like, you can't fix it because that's the thing about the left is once they gain power. Once they gain power, their goal is to create a system that allows for permanent control. The left believes in one-party rule. The Democrats always seek to win and then rig the system so they cannot lose. So once you've allowed that to happen in your state, your options are severely limited. So I think other people watching around the country, if you live in another state, need to say, look, we cannot allow them to win, because if they win, they will rig the system in their favor, and then we'll lose in perpetuity. Like California's loss, for example. California cannot be fixed through the ballot box. There is just no electoral path to fix California. This has been ruled by Democrats for too long, and they rigged the game. The deck is completely stacked against any opponent. So we've lost California to winning through the ballot box alone. Now, I still think there are options other than violence that the conservative movement has to look at exploiting, because we cannot continue to live in this mentality that we will cede government institutions and we won't use the ones we have, and then we're going to go directly to our AR-15s. Now, it may get to the point where that's the only option left, and I think in 2020 there were some examples of that all that was left. I mean, if people did not resort to threatening to actually go to war in Virginia, the Virginia legislature would have pushed through legislation when it banned 80% of the weapons in Virginia. So obviously there is a place to say this far, no further. If you cross this line, we're going to go to war. But look at how much territory in Virginia, as a case in point, is deep red territory, where if you had a county board of supervisors or you had a mayor or a city council that was willing to say, in this county, in this town, in this city, we will not impose any of this insanity. I think that's the other attitude we got to take. You can use local government to do what Ron DeSantis did. It's harder at the local level than is when you control the governor's mansion. So we have to have the mentality where you use local government to carve out sectors of freedom, even in deep blue states. And that's an option still available to us. Even the voting laws. So we say, okay, Virginia made a bunch of crazy voting laws. What if your county says, no, we're going to pass local voting ordinances to make sure we maintain free and fair elections in our county? And then when the Virginia Supreme Court says they're illegal, you go, no, just ignore that. Because you guys are actually the ones that are cheating. You guys are the ones that are destroying our laws, and we're just not going to allow that in our county.
Well, that's a great strategy, because that's what they do. That's what they've done. That's what they did.
Exactly. The left never accepts defeat. If they lose in the court, they ignore the court. If they win in the court, then they reverence the court as if it was Moses coming off Mount Sinai. And we have to take a similar approach. Now, we can't be as duplicitive as they are. We can't lie. But we can say, look, if the court has a constitutional ruling, sure, we'll recognize it. But there is no justification to impose an unconstitutional, unjust law. Just not. And that's why multiple layers of government exist, to protect you from the higher level of government. So local governments need to say, look, we're not doing any of this garbage in our county, including voting laws. No. We will maintain, you have to vote in person, you have to vote with an ID, and we'll impose all these things locally with local ordinances and laws. And what, is the governor of Virginia going to send the state police to go and arrest your board of supervisors because you want to impose different voting laws or your local electoral board? No.
Well, I'd be okay with that. When I was involved in the Tea Party, I had the census people come, and I refused to answer their questions other than four. That's how many people live here. And they would tell me, well, you know, you can be charged. And I said, you go ahead and you do that. You come, you charge me. I'm really looking forward to fighting that fight. So you know, come on. And you know, so many people I think aren't willing to fight with words. So I wonder how much they'll fight, you know, with their arms. But let's switch to a hypothetical here, so we can have conversation, because some of the stuff we can't talk about if it's here, but we can talk about hypothetically if this was South Africa. And you know, looking at us right now, we essentially have the militia that isn't all across the state. You know, 5 people, 10 people, 15 people, you know, does not make a militia. And so that's one problem I think that we have here. And I'm sure they have that same problem in South Africa. So think about if we have to take action, what should small groups be training for? Because I think small unit infantry stuff is hard to do if you don't have enough people, but also I don't know how useful that particular, you know, type of training, running around in the woods, would be, let's say, if you lived in South Africa.
So I think there's kind of, I have to separate two types of groups. So if you are a small survivalist kind of prepper group, you know, you and a handful of your buddies, you're 5 to 10 people, and you're saying, what do we need to do to prepare for some sort of catastrophe, right? I think I would focus more on things that are much more practical, like, do you have medical gear? Do you know how to use it? I mean, I was reading a scenario the other day, and I realized, you know what, man, I don't know how to do a blood transfusion or have the equipment for that. You know, what do you do? There's no blood banks. I can't go to a hospital. I can't get an IV. You know, there's some very practical stuff like that. Do I know how to purify water? How much food do I have on hand? Some stuff that's much more on the prepper end of that. But when it comes to weapons and training like that, you say, okay, do I have a good comm plan for my small group of guys in one neighborhood? If the phone lines are out, how will we communicate? You know, is it ham radio? Is it some other way? And then when it comes to small unit tactics and stuff like that, yeah, are there certain things like running around the woods and being able to do a squad or platoon ambush? How useful is that in a lot of scenarios? Well, if you're kind of on the prepper end of things, that's not very useful at all. So it's how familiar am I with my kit? Can I actually employ my weapon? You know, what's my max effective range? Not what my weapon can do, but what can I actually do? And then if I'm with two or three people, can I do something as simple as clear a room? Like I go to my buddy's house and get the guy out of there, or I got to shoot my way out of my neighborhood. You know, there's some very practical weapons drills and things you can do with like three or four guys that you don't need to do a whole lot of, you know, regular infantry training to do. That'd be very valuable in doing something like getting your family out of a city that has been taken over by Antifa or is having massive rioting and looting. And most of that is individual weapons training, first aid, and regular prepper type stuff. And even a situation like South Africa, you know, there's some examples of huge groups of people going and destroying, you know, a white farm or something like that, or someone who's considered a class enemy, or I'm not an expert on South Africa, just some stuff I've read. But a lot of it is still small groups of guys. It's more like what you see in the United States still. You know, it's a handful of Antifa-type thugs that is either going to go up to one person or go attack one business or one block or something like that. Or even if it's a big group of people, you only have to shoot a couple people and the rest of them scatter, which you saw in, you know, multiple incidences with Antifa and BLM and their, you know, mayhem through certain cities. So, yeah, I agree with you that there doesn't need to be like this huge focus on building, you know, a formal military organization for that type of stuff. Now, if you're a second type of group and you're saying, no, we're preparing for something a little more high intense, which is, okay, the crap hits the fan and we're looking at the emergence of local warlords, breakdown of American society, or the imposition of localized tyrannies like CHAZ, or, you know, something much bigger, state or federal tyrannical government type of action, or the United States breaks into factions and you're still dealing with, you know, enemy paramilitary or quasi-military or competing military factions like a, you know, a fully militarized Antifa group. Well, then you are going to need some real infantry training. You are going to know how to do real small unit tactics. But even then, I think a lot of groups make mistakes where they try and do too much. You know, look at, I'm not a soldier. Most guys are not soldiers. You think about your militia guys and you look, I'm not a soldier. I'm a civilian trying to learn some stuff. So what should I do? Maybe you have a couple of veterans in your group. Great. Use those guys where you can, but focus on doing two or three battle drills. You know, can I do a patrol? Can I do an ambush? Can I react to contact? And get good at two or three things and focus on that instead of trying to duplicate a full military training schedule and regimen, because that's just not realistic for most groups. Very few groups can successfully do that.
Well, who say how much of what people should be focusing on is, say, you know, tradecraft or encryption or technology or keeping your mouth shut when you get caught, you know, stuff like that.
So I'm not a technical expert on stuff like encryption. Let's flat out tell you that. My general view of that type of tech is there are some people I know who are really confident in being able to do digital stuff and hide it. I personally am not confident that there's really a whole lot that can be hidden digitally. especially depending on what type of, if you're focusing on a state threat, for example, like a totalitarian government, especially our government. If our government becomes totalitarian, this is one of the things that came out of the Snowden defection. So Snowden defected to Russia, and when Russia found out the surveillance capability and the, you know, data penetration capability the United States had, Russia took its most highly classified documents and highly classified processes information and made it all analog, because the Russian government concluded that they couldn't hide it. They couldn't defeat the United States cyber capability. So they had to take it completely off digital. So I figure if Russia, a state power, can't protect itself from the United States and had to go analog, then I highly doubt that any private group is going to be able to do any better. So if you're really concerned about hiding what you're doing, I think it has to be analog. That's also what you see with our enemies we fought in the Middle East. You know, the only terrorist organization that survived, or insurgency group survived in the Middle East, were the ones who went pure analog. Anybody else, we eventually got in and figured out where they are and blow them up with a cruise missile or a hellfire.
Well, yeah, it took them a while to learn that lesson, but I think that so that comes back to my question, you know, about you know, tradecraft and that other kind of stuff. So, you know, there's a story I've been trying to trace down some details on from South Africa, where, you know, crime has become a real big problem there. And basically a bunch of people went through, got fed up with the crime. They knew who was doing it. They rounded them all up, put them in a soccer field and killed them all. And I think with everything that we see with the, you know, the defund the police and basically encouraging police never to go on calls, I think it's very likely you could see that kind of a South Africa situation there. I just don't think Americans are going to put up with that, you know, and that's we're in a different position because we have way more guns than South Africa has, you know, I think in that. But a bunch of these people have been found and arrested, and I'm still trying to, you know, track down the details here. But I don't think that would have happened if they had had, you know, tradecraft and kind of a little better planning ahead. So, you know, going analog is definitely important. There's a great article that I need to track down, and it was about the metadata and applied to the Revolutionary War. If you had had the connection points of Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine and these different people, and you knew that, and the British knew that back then, that they could have just selectively taken a few guys out of the equation and boom, that would have been that. And I think that beyond that, metadata, just knowing who's been close to somebody else, that technology, you know, is powerful. And so going analog would be a huge step forward. I just don't see Americans, I look at from a personal aspect, I got a bunch of murders and rapes happen in my neighborhood. I'm not putting up with that anymore. I'm just going to deal with it. You know, I'm not going to call the cops. It's just going to get dealt with. And I think most Americans are that way. But the problem I see is they don't know how to shut up. You know, don't talk to the police. There's all this, well, you know, it was this and it was that. And even guys, there's video, all kinds of videos all over YouTube of guys that have defended themselves, disarmed the bad guy, and then they walk out in cuffs and, you know, while they don't even arrest the bad guy. So, because they talked. So, I don't know if you have any insights into that. I mean, you know, if you can confirm, yeah, you need to not talk to the police. That's what lawyers are for.
So obviously I think that this is just wise, that if you're going to have an interaction with law enforcement outside of anything more than a speeding ticket, obviously, I mean, honestly, yeah, you should have some legal representation there, and that should be very calculated with a lawyer in mind, because this is the mentality we have to shake. I don't think it's that you don't talk to the police, period. I don't think it's that the police are the enemy, because this varies widely from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. What I do think needs to happen on the right, and this is with every American institution that we give honor and reverence towards, whether it's the police or the military, is we need to say we have so destroyed certain sectors of our society, and our government has become so corrupt, our education system has become so corrupt, there are no sacred cows left. There is no all cops are good, all soldiers are good, thank you for your service, all veterans are good. No. We got to get out of that. That's American nostalgia and a stupid form of patriotism and affinity for institutions. And that needs to be abandoned. If the police are going to defend my God-given rights, if they are going to punish, if they are going to kill people who are trying to kill me and kill other Americans, which is what they should do, like that cop who shot the girl who's going to stab the other one, that's exactly what that cop should have done. If the police are going to defend your God-given rights, that police department, that sheriff, that police chief, that individual officer deserves your respect, admiration, and in the right situations, cooperation. But if you live in Baltimore or Chicago or Detroit or Portland, and if you shoot an Antifa guy who is trying to burn down your business, you get arrested and thrown in prison, those police are the enemy. That police department has made themselves an enemy of the people because they won't punish the people who are breaking the law, and they only want to punish the people who are defending themselves. They've turned themselves into a left-wing enforcement squad. They're quislings. They're collaborators. They're just like the good German policemen who enforce the edicts of the Nazi party. You know, the German policemen just following orders. Those guys are not to be respected. No, we don't back the blue. No. The badge means nothing. It's what you do with the badge. There is no longer honor attached to these institutions by default. Same thing with the military. If the military is trained to defeat America's enemies overseas, fighting America's wars, protecting American values, upholding the Constitution, that commander, that unit, that institution deserves our honor and reverence. But the minute they say, no, you believe in the actual Constitution, there's some sort of radical and extremist, we're going to purge people, or we're going to use military force as the boot on the throat of American freedom, then all reverence to the military should go out the window. All respect for the military should go out the window. And that's, I think, the mentality we need to break. Is that conservatives still, by and large, have a very simplistic view of certain institutions. And the police definitely fall into that camp. I don't know if that was kind of the answer. That wasn't the subject you're looking for there, but that's what came to mind when you brought up that example.
Yeah, sure. Let's move on to the topic of cancel culture, because I think we saw in the last couple of weeks a great counter-cancel culture example and what we should be doing, finding every opportunity to cancel the cancel culture. And this was the book by Matthew Lohmeyer, Irresistible Revolution. He was the Space Force Lieutenant Colonel who was relieved, and exposing the Marxist stuff. I think it's a bestseller on Amazon right now. It is. You can't even get it because they're sold out. You got to make more. And I don't even want the book, but I'm going to buy it because it's a great example of canceling the cancel culture. And you know, if we don't want something, doesn't matter. If it's $20, go get it, because it throws it back in their face, and no matter what they do, they can't they can scream and, you know, yell all they want. But if you have you bought the book, you've supported the guy, and now he doesn't need the job you just got him fired from. I don't know how we put that into practical action, but we've talked about creating our own little economy, which is tough to do, but this is a great example. Unfortunately, it's mostly being done through Amazon. And you know, they're making lots of money, and they're part of the problem. But I think it's a great example of counter cancel culture, and I don't know any other way to fight them.
So I think that there's three ways to push back on the cancel culture, and you hit one right on the head and with this example here. And that is that we should reward people who take risk to actually counter what's going on in our culture and our politics right now. If you're willing to swim upstream and fight against the radical left and you lose your job, this guy lost his command, getting kicked out of the military. Yes. Even if that book is like a mediocre book, like I haven't read it. I've heard some people give a positive review of it, but it doesn't matter. That guy wrote a book on a real problem, the Marxist infiltration of the military, and he was kicked out for it. That guy should be a number one national bestseller, even if the book is somewhat mediocre. Because that guy stuck his head out to actually confront the left. Yes, absolutely reward anyone who does that. Now, there's obviously limits to that. People can be really stupid in their confrontation, but you know what I'm saying, right? If it's even a half-decent effort, that person deserves to be rewarded. So that's one. Two, we always want to, like, we get kind of discouraged because we think that it's impossible to push back into these massive corporations where it's like, oh, all the corporations turn against us, which did pretty much happen. If you're a major corporation, you're leaning left right now. So let's take COVID fascism, for example. If every restaurant in your town says we are going to impose masks or a social credit system, we all did masks, but either social credit system or something like that, or the vaccine passport, right? Are you going to be able to lead an effective boycott against every single business in your town? No. But you don't have to. Imagine how the mask mandate would have been different if in every town, groups of conservatives got together and said, we're going to lead a boycott against one business. I can't not go to every restaurant, but we can pick one. Like you say, there's only one McDonald's franchise in our town. We're going to lead a town-wide boycott of that one McDonald's franchise. We won't put all, we can't avoid every restaurant, but we're going to put that McDonald's out of business. And sure, we'll be like, oh, well, it's not that franchise owner's fault. No, it is. Because there's all sorts of franchises where corporate office said, hey, mask mandate. And then you walked into that restaurant, and it was that individual franchise owner who decided how vigorously he wanted to enforce that policy. Corporations don't have absolute power over their franchise. We saw that all throughout the COVID pandemic. But if you made the point, we can't get rid of you all at once, but one at a time, we will leave boycotts and put you out of business until you change your policies. The COVID fascism would have been radically different. It would have been cut short if people would have done stuff like that. The last thing, we need to put incredible pressure on our politicians, and let's just be for real, most of them are crap, need to be replaced anyway. We need to elect people who say they will use the power of the state to punish left-wing companies. And there's all the conservatives, there's all the libertarians, and some conservatives out there look like, oh no, that's just playing their game, and blah, 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 and that's not who we are, and the free market, the free market, the free market. We're going to have free market gulags in America. Like, it'll be the gulag brought to you by Amazon. You put that mentality. We need people who will use the power of the state to punish corporations that use their power as a corporate entity to impose on the rights and liberties of the American people. And you can do that at the local level. You can do it at the state level. Definitely, unfortunately, there's a lot of opportunities to do the national level that Republicans never use. But that is a huge piece of this that, for the most part, conservatives have been uncomfortable with it and won't even talk about it. But we should use political power to punish woke capital.
Good.
Well, I'd like to know what your thoughts are on the things we've talked about in this episode. You can go to Podbean and leave a comment there. Love to hear your thoughts. You can shoot an email to me at producer@radiofreevirginia.com. You can go to the website, radiofreevirginia.com, and you can leave a message there on the contact page. But I'd like to thank you for listening. And remind you, You were not made to fit in, you were born to stand out. I'm Hank Reardon, this is Radio Free Virginia. God bless you.